Professor Glaser, First Amendment class, 24th November, podcast number 1 in room number 205.
What was the fair debt collection practices act? Maybe we'll see if we can have some federal statute. Fair debt collection practices act.
Fair debt collection FDCPA.
Yeah. The fair debt collection practice act. And that talks about restrictions on collecting debts, if that's what you're talking about.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's why I left.
I don't know. My voice is not normal today, so I'm just might sound weird and be quieter. So what we're going to do today is continue per the syllabus along with our discussion of the Establishment Clause Doctrine, which of course is one of two Religion Clause Doctrines, the other being the Free Exercise Clause. So we started talking about and had a pretty rich discussion of the Wiseman case, but I want to kind of rein in our discussion, which, while very lively, I just want to make sure that the kind of doctrinal principles emerge from a discussion of that case. So, does anyone want to just remind us, please, what happened in that case? Graduation. Yeah.
The prayer from the rabbi that other students, like school tested, like the prayer that I'm doing at high school graduation, of course, that was really
Yeah. So, right. So this is the case where a principal of the public high school got this rabbi to deliver a speech at graduation, and it's obviously, for a good reason, a big part of the case and a big part of the court's opinion that with the invitation to this rabbi that was extended, there was this, you know, pamphlet or set of guidelines for how to make a speech that's kind of non-sectarian and non-religious. So despite the fact that this was a rabbi giving a prayer, you know, it was a contention of the school because of the way in which the school handled this, namely by offering these guidelines to the rabbi about how to give his speech, that, you know, the speech would not be religious, in which case, why would that be less problematic for the purposes of the Establishment Clause? It's an easy question, but I just want to kind of make sure that we're, you know, doctrinally rigorous here.
I'm not sure.
So why would it be supportive for the school that, for the school's case, that this was not in violation of the Establishment Clause, that the school gave these guidelines to the rabbi?
Well, because it wasn't like a religious speech. It was more like that. It was kind of more neutral.
Right. So here, you know, just remember that, you know, the Establishment Clause provides that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And, you know, if there is more of a linkage between the state, the public school in this case, the government, and whatever the religious message is, then that's going to be more likely to violate the Establishment Clause versus less of a link, right, or less of a strong link or whatever, is going to be less likely to violate the Establishment Clause. This case, by the way, before we go on, for those of you who might have kind of a sticking point in, you know, your understanding of this case, it seems like the type of case that would fall not under the Establishment Clause, but instead the Free Exercise Clause. And I know that we haven't gotten into the Free Exercise Clause except as, you know, an introductory matter. But if someone were to say that, and if I told you that it's at least, you know, plausible that people do say that, which I'm telling you that that's true, why would that be the case, even if you don't know everything about the Free Exercise Clause? The Free Exercise Clause provides, just to get the wording out, I'll just look to the outline here, the Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. And, you know, the case here involves one particular student and the claims of that student, by way of her parents, that she was prevented from, you know, participating in the way that, you know, she would have wanted to, would have been natural to her, with respect to a religious matter, right? Why would that be a free exercise claim as opposed to an establishment claim?
Mm-hmm. Because it's like the manner that you're exercising religious beliefs versus like kind of like where the connection between location and state. So.
I guess so. Well, when you say, and again, this is somewhat tricky to go down this discussion road without first having, you know, a complete discussion of the Free Exercise Clause, which we'll get to not until Wednesday, right? But I think it's important, even as a preliminary matter, even not understanding everything that we could possibly understand about the Free Exercise Clause, to have this discussion. Because part of the task on you as First Amendment students is to understand, you know, the difference between the religion clauses. Of course, they both have to do with religion. So anytime you see, you know, some sort of speech by a rabbi, something that kind of screams religion, you can be pretty sure that you're to invoke one or both of the religion clauses. But deciding between the religion clauses can be tricky, right? So here, you know, you can make a claim. And if you read the words of, you know, the Free Exercise Clause, that Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion, versus the Establishment Clause, that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And you think about the fact that this case is about one person in a sea of students, right? And her ability to either participate, not participate, you know, do something, do nothing, have her own kind of decision, right, about how much she wants to participate in this event. You're always going to have a rule, whether it be a school policy, an ordinance, a statute, that says something about religion, right? In either case, because that's all of constitutional law, it's definitely all of the First Amendment. We always have some rule here at the school policy that because the state is the school and because the policy is in effect a rule, because even though people don't have to go to graduation, as the case elaborates, they effectively have to go to graduation, right? It's not a rule in the sense that you're going to be suspended or you won't be able to graduate if you don't go to graduation or something like this, but it's an effective rule, it's a de facto rule. So if that's true, that we're always going to be dealing with some sort of a rule, and in this case, the effect of that rule is on Deborah Wiseman's decision or lack of a decision to participate or not participate, and the degree to which she wants to participate in that graduation that has as a part of it this prayer interlude, right?
why would that be more is the wrong word. Why would that be plausibly a free exercise claim as opposed to an establishment claim?
Yeah.
Well, when you, like, just look at them both, like you said, like, there's a lot of run area. But when you look at the establishment claim, usually you look to see whether the government is trying to establish a religion.
Right.
And in this case, you're talking about the right of one individual to not do what everybody else is doing.
Mm-hmm.
That seems more like free exercise of the individual rather than the state imposing a religion.
Yeah.
Especially because a good fact for the school in terms of establishment is the fact that they have this, like, non-sectarian policy.
Right.
That they affirmatively attempted not to establish.
Right. Exactly. So I think those two reasons are exactly the reasons. That it's at least plausible, and that some have argued, as a result of the plausibility, that this is not an appropriate establishment clause claim, but instead is more appropriately framed as a free exercise claim. Now, the difference between whether this would be a free exercise case and whether this would be an establishment case, as it is now, right, and how doctrine would fall. Would be any different if one were the appropriate clause versus another is beyond the scope of our discussion right this second, because that would require us to have a really intimate knowledge of what it requires to adjudicate a free exercise case, which we won't get to until Wednesday. But for the moment, I want to just kind of, you know, put before you this idea that there is debate about whether the Wiseman case in particular is appropriately cast as a free exercise case, which it's not currently, or an establishment clause case. Okay, so to repeat what Ruth said very nicely, and doesn't really bear repeating, but I know that sometimes when I repeat it, it becomes clearer, or not me specifically, but, you know, whoever stands in these shoes. Is that, you know, on the one hand, here we have a case where the school is affirmatively saying that they are not establishing a particular religion. The way that they support that affirmative statement is by way of this guideline that they give to the rabbi before he gives his speech. You know, the guidelines for how to make a non-sectarian sort of speech. So they're definitely not establishing a religion. That's not what this is about. And if you think back to, you know, the history, the reading for not last time, but the time before, right, the history of the religion clauses, the establishment clause in particular does not sound anything like what's going on here, right? The establishment clause derives from a history of the state saying, well, we want to incentivize people to go to this church. We want, you know, people to join this religion. And that's not what's going on here, right? The state is not saying, you know, we want everybody to listen to Rabbi Leslie whomever, and be Jewish, or be the type of Jewish that this rabbi is. Not happening. You know, what most likely happened was, you know, the principal's friends with somebody who's friends with this rabbi, you know, lives down the block, who knows, come give a speech. Maybe he's a really great speaker. Maybe he's not. You know, here are some guidelines about how to make this non-religious to the extent you can, and you're on. This is not about providing tax breaks to join the particular church down the block. And that seems to be what the Establishment Clause is trying to eradicate historically. Of course, a footnote to that is, well, how much does the history really matter, right, which is something that we've discussed. But one thing you can't deny, especially when you're choosing between an Establishment Clause claim and a free exercise claim, is you've got to pay mind to the history in order to choose between the two types of claims. So I'm not suggesting that the history of either clause, or any constitutional clause for that matter, should be dispositive of whatever issue brought under that clause, right, about the adjudication of any issue brought under that clause. But it should be something you consider when deciding, for example, between two clauses that are pretty alike, the types of claims that clause was intended to cover. And it seems as though there's at least an argument that this particular situation of the high school with the rabbi, you know, the principal getting the rabbi to speak that doesn't sound like the type of thing where the principal and, you know, by proxy the state is trying to get even these students to convert, right, or to incentivize them to follow any particular creed or any particular message that this rabbi is offering. So that's I think one of the main reasons that this is more appropriately cast as a free exercise claim as opposed to an Establishment Clause claim, according to those who have said that that's the case. The other reason is that here we're talking about, you know, one particular student, right, or at least one particular student who's brought a claim. Not to say that there may have been others, right? But we know of one student, Deborah Wiseman, in this graduating class who felt uncomfortable, or at least was convinced by her parents that she should feel uncomfortable. A nod to Tinker here. So here we have, you know, one student who felt out of place, and as though she didn't have, you know, the appropriate choices before her because she was effectively coerced into, you know, going through the motions that this particular prayer indicated that she should go through. And that is the type of claim that we would most likely see in the context of a free exercise claim, right? If you think about what we said last time, which was, and this was a conversation I had with Reva, when I asked her, if you remember, because on this side of the board, I wrote, you know, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, and I asked her which of the two would have a more likely parallel to the Free Speech Clauses. And after some conversation, you know, we decided that it was more likely that the Free Exercise Clause would have more of a parallel to the Free Speech Clauses. Why was that? Because when we're talking about the free speech clauses, we're talking about the fact that the state shouldn't influence your ability to express yourself in a particular way. So if you have one viewpoint as opposed to another viewpoint, then the state is not supposed to get in your way of expressing it. There were parallels between the Establishment Clause and the Speech Clause as well. For example, the Establishment Clause says that that the state can't influence, right, or at least some of the eight possible interpretations or approaches to the Establishment Clause indicate that, you know, the state can't influence your decision to go with one religion or another, which seems similar to the way in which the state can't incentivize your decision to go with one viewpoint over another viewpoint, right? That's the whole idea behind viewpoint discrimination. But the Free Exercise Clause bears more obvious parallels between the speech clause. So here we're talking about, you know, a particular student's ability to express herself religiously or non-religiously, right? Which seems like a type of speech claim, right? More so than this situation seems like a situation where the state or the school, as the state, is imposing on its students one particular religion. Now, it's not crucial that you understand, you know, the reasons why the Wiseman case in particular should be an Establishment Clause claim or whether it should be a free exercise claim. But the fruit of this discussion is supposed to be that in the next case, right, not Lynch, but the next hypothetical case, you can understand that if there is a particular religion situation that you have up to you, you have a menu of choices, really just two, so it's kind of like a prefix menu of choices. You have two choices, you know, whether to bring an Establishment Clause claim or to bring a free exercise claim, or you can bring both. But that either of those are going to work in separate ways. Here, the Wiseman case was an Establishment Clause claim. But there's at least a possible way that you could frame this same situation as a free exercise claim. And when we finish talking about the Free Exercise Clause next time, I want to go back for 5 minutes and just think about if the Wiseman case were a free exercise case in fact, how, if at all, would the disposition of that case be different? Okay. So getting back to Wiseman, which was an Establishment Clause claim, even though it could have been cast, for reasons we've just enunciated, as a free exercise case, it was an Establishment Clause case. We've said the facts, and I want to just go through, you know, the points raised by the majority, and the points on the other side that Justice Scalia offered as counterpoints to Justice Kennedy's majority opinion. So we've got this this idea that the government can't coerce anyone to support or participate in religion or its exercise, or otherwise act in a way which establishes a state religion or religious faith, or tends to do so. And that's a quote on the top of page 567 that derives from the Lynch versus Donnelly case that follows in the materials. And the contention of the majority is that what the state did here violates those central principles, that you can't coerce and you can't establish a particular religion which would effectively coerce everybody in an audience like this one to follow that religion. So from a constitutional perspective, the court continues, it's as if a state statute decreed that the prayers must occur. So that's the link between the fact that this is a school policy or really just, you know, something the school is doing. It's not even capped in the policy. It's something the school has decided to do in the context of graduation that is effectively like a rule. And the court continues that because what the school did here was like a rule, and because they did this in the context of graduation, there was really no way for the students to avoid the effects of the school's rule. And they say that, the court says that, at the end of this paragraph that begins divisiveness on page 567, saying that the student had no real alternative which would have allowed her to avoid the fact or appearance of participation. Now, then the court goes on to mention this whole non-sectarian business, right? That there was, you know, a pamphlet that the principal gave to the rabbi that said, here's how to give a pretty bland speech that doesn't involve, you know, any particular religion. Before then, the court enunciating exactly what the question was in this case. And that comes at the end of the paragraph beginning Petitioners Argue, also on page 567, that reads, the question is not the good faith of the school in attempting to make the prayer acceptable to most persons, but the legitimacy of its undertaking, that enterprise at all, when the object is to produce a prayer to be used in a formal religious exercise which students, for all practical purposes, are obliged to attend. Okay. So really, the fact that the school is offering as evidence of its, you know, non-religious affiliation, that there was this pamphlet, this set of guidelines that were given to the rabbi before he could make his speech, that doesn't really go to the question here, because the question is not about whether the school had the good faith of doing something that was supposed to be non-religious, but instead what the effects of that, what the effects of the speech were, the legitimacy of the undertaking at all, when the object of this undertaking, of having a religious speech, or a speech by a rabbi, we don't have to call it a religious speech, is to produce a prayer to be used in a formal religious exercise which students are obliged to attend for all practical purposes. Okay. So basically, you know, there's a lot of the court's reasoning that goes to the idea that even though this was not a policy, this wasn't an actual rule, right? If you look at the student handbook, there's nothing about this. So even though that's true, because of the way that graduation works in settings like this, there's an effective or de facto obligation for the students to attend, despite the fact that they don't have to. There is also a nice quote if you're looking for evidence of the divide of the debate between the religion clauses being religion, freedom of religion, versus the religion clauses being freedom for from religion, rather, which is on page 568 at the end of the first full paragraph there. It must not be forgotten, then, that while concern must be given to define the protection granted to an objector or a dissenting nonbeliever, these same clauses, the religion clauses, exist to protect religion from government interference. So here, you know, there is this an articulation of the fact that, you know, the religion clauses are meant to do both. They are meant to provide to individual people, most likely dissenters who feel as though they're not within the majority religion, to do what they want religiously, to practice however they feel they should. But that's not the only purpose of the religion clauses. The religion clauses are also there to protect the individuals, the populace, from the government's interference with religion. Okay. So what... We talked last time about the fact that the students here effectively couldn't avoid going to graduation. And moreover, that even if they could effectively avoid going to graduation, they couldn't effectively avoid going to graduation, and also that if because they couldn't effectively avoid it, so they're already there, and once they're there, they can't really effectively avoid having to do everything that is required of, you know, the entire audience of graduates to do at the graduation. And we talked about the fact that the way that the court knew that was by way of psychology, essentially. We don't have, you know, all of the citations here, but essentially, you know, I told you that beginning in Brown versus Board of Education, in footnote 11 of Brown versus Board of Education, there was this big, you know, deal made of the fact that the court in Brown used psychology texts in a footnote. In a footnote particularly describing the harms that segregated children felt in the context of these of segregated school systems. One second. I didn't realize that my voice was getting so prepubescent. I actually, like, don't feel that sick, but, you know, when you sound this way, it just sounds, like, miserable. Poor me. Okay. So, in any event, so in Brown, you know, we have this tradition that started, and it's a pretty hotly contested tradition. As you can imagine, you know, people aren't so, like, not everybody is super psyched about the fact that the Brown Court initiated this project of citing psychological sources. Right. Why? Well, we talked last time, and I think Allison and Patrick offered thoughts to this end, which is that, one, you know, psychology sources change all the time, right? In the same way that any sort of scientific sources change all the time. You know, one day, this is how depression most affects you. The next day, that is how depression most affects you. You know, you hear about these things on the news, but certainly they do change. So that's one. And two, which builds upon one, the people who are most apt to interpret these sources are definitely not lawyers, definitely not judges, and they're also not going to be the ones who are most likely to know about or to interpret correctly whatever changes have happened in those fields, right? So, for example, I am in the midst of a project about hate speech, where one of the points I make is that the concept of aggression in hate speech cases is somewhat outdated. So basically, you know, there's this idea that you know, you've got to be so aggressive in order to then, like, to have a particular piece of conduct or piece of speech go over a line in order to qualify as hate speech. And that line is generally crossed by way of the speech being really, really aggressive. But the concept of aggression that courts use is, I contend,
somewhat outdated, and I draw on literature about relational aggression, which is the type of aggression that's probably most commonly associated with the movie Mean Girls, which is kind of like indirect aggression, that sort of thing, you know, making alliances amongst people. That type of aggression is not at all factored into the court's decision, such that then, you know, very aggressive, but not obviously aggressive in a traditional way, speech or conduct doesn't cross the line, whereas the only you know, type of speech or conduct that does cross the line to become hate speech is the type that is associated with classical aggression. So that's an example, just like Brown is, of what the court is doing in Wiseman, which is saying, you know, well, we know, right, because psychologists know, that, you know, there's this idea that there's a lot of pressure in schools. And I imagine that it wasn't that hard to find, you know, sources that suggest that high school is not exactly a time that's free from peer pressure, right? Such that if everybody's wearing whatever, right, from the Gap, or from, you know, somewhere else, I know this is Hofstra, so I have to update, then it's not totally crazy that everybody else would wear that too, right? It's not totally crazy that, you know, if everybody's standing or if everybody is, you know, wearing their hair in a side pony or something like that, that everybody else would too. These are not, you know, shocking sorts of psychological conclusions in the context of a high school environment. So it's also not shocking that, you know, whatever psychological sources this court drew upon led this court to the conclusion that even though there's no gun to anyone's head, even though the school says you don't have to come to graduation, and moreover, if you do come to graduation, you also don't have to stand, you don't have to pray, you don't have to do anything, but Rabbi Leslie, whomever, is going to give his speech. And some people are going to be standing, and he's probably going to say, you know, at some point, please rise. Right? Such that if you were generally inclined to do what everyone else is doing, or to listen to a speaker who has the floor at any given time, you would probably be inclined to also please rise and to say whatever was being said or mumbled. So, and we talked about, you and I, talked about the fact that, you know, there is some merit to the argument that this is actual coercion, and there's also some merit to the idea that there's not, right? And that seems to be, I want to get a running list of, in the Wiseman case, we'll have a Kennedy-Scalia, you know, point-counterpoint going on over here, that this is, you know, psychological coercion. And the counterpoint to Kennedy's psychological coercion to stand and to do stuff bless you while you're standing, Scalia says, you know, that psychological coercion is not actual coercion. And then he goes on to say that even if it was, even if psychological coercion were equal to actual coercion, here, the psychological coercion at issue only mandates that students do what? Yep. That students stand. And I'll put in quotes, stand, exclamation point, which is from the Scalia dissent here. Now, I know Mark, you know, articulated the view that, sure, even though this is Scalia's counterpoint to Justice Kennedy's point about psychological coercion, and Scalia's intent clearly is to disaggregate, right, to separate the standing from whatever the standing is intended to do, right? Even though that's his point, it's not possible, right, in this case to separate the standing from the reason that students would be psychologically or actually coerced to do that, right? So Scalia's point is it doesn't matter, right? First of all, it's not actual coercion. And even if it were actual coercion, the actual coercion at issue would be the actual coercion to stand, which is not something that's so objectionable. And it's a clever point, right? Even if you disagree with it, it's a clever point, which I don't think you would disagree with either, Mark. Because, you know, we're all comfortable with various, you know, various innocuous rules that tell us that we've got to walk, stand, you know, do various things. Our liberty is taken away all the time in very unobjectionable ways. The example I elaborated on last time was that of traffic regulations, which I think are appropriate here only because those are, you know, non-speech related, non-religious related reasons that we're told to move in particular ways. Now, it's also, you know, an opportunity for you, Mark, to say what you said last time, which is, well, traffic regulations are inherently different from what's going on here. So even though it's Scalia's intent, thought, you know, what he's trying to do here is to separate standing, which we're comfortable in isolation having the government tell us to do, from, you know, this other stuff, right, the religious stuff, which we're inherently not comfortable having the government tell us to do, even though what he's trying to do is to make whatever is coerced here as unobjectionable as a traffic regulation, there's not really a way to do that because, you know, there could be lots of reasons. One might be, for example, in the context of traffic regulations, there is a reason, you know, that we've got to cross when there's a little man on the, you know, the light, not cross when he's not there, to go on one side versus another side of the street, to stop, to go, et cetera, et cetera. There are actual reasons for that, whereas here, fine, even if the only thing that this is requiring of the students is to stand, and standing in itself is not objectionable, I could say, well, maybe standing, maybe, you know, having someone be coerced to stand is objectionable without, you know, some good reason like we have in the context of traffic regulations. I imagine that then Justice Scalia, or the hypothetical interlocutor who would assume Justice Scalia's position, would say something back to me like, well, maybe that's true, i.e., maybe it's true that, you know, in the context of traffic regulations or other times when the government tells you to stand or sit or stop or go, there are other reasons that the government has to do that, but that doesn't mean that this particular coercion, if you want to call it that, says Justice Scalia, violates the religion clauses, right? So that's his purpose. And Mark, I think, would still say, you know, well, this is an artificially kind of manufactured argument. You can't separate the standing from anything else. That was your position last time. Because here, you know, the standing is inherent to whatever the prayer calls for, whatever the reason is that you're standing. I saw a hand, and I don't... Allison, was it you?
Mm-hmm. Because the rabbi going on saying he could not have done this without God. And that is like, that is an indoctrination because that is saying you couldn't have graduated. Here we are giving you a diploma telling you God is the one who does it. It's more than just standing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's to some extent right. I think you don't even have to say, you don't even have to go so far as to say the only way you can do this was God, because I don't know that I agree with that. But there's certainly two mentions here of something God-like. There's God, the first word, and then there's we give thanks to you, Lord, in the second to last line. So there's certainly an acknowledgement
of some higher being named either God or Lord, whether it's the same being or not, such that, you know, standing at that point would be different from standing or sitting or stopping or going in the context of a street, right? So I think that is helpful to Mark's case, right, which is it's hard to separate because why are you standing? You're standing because the name of God is being said. Yeah, Don?
I don't have a well-thought-out opinion. It's just, I just like Mark. I think it's interesting that in this context, like anything, any words referring to a God or something, it becomes like an epithet. It's sort of context. And I have trouble like working around that.
Right.
But I think like what Scalia was trying to say was compelling, not why he said it, but the reasons he gave for it, but I'm having trouble understanding the court aspect of it, like why it actually is.
Right. I want to spend a little more time on whether it was coercive, but to focus on your first point, which I think is very interesting. Here, you know, it's any mention of God is taken to be kind of a bad thing because we're trying to ascertain whether this was religious, and so a mention of God seems to make something more religious as opposed to less religious. Whereas, you know, it's for example not different from the cases like the hate speech cases or the profanity cases or even the obscenity cases, where we're picking out from particular material, you know, exposure, nakedness, you know, words that are bad words, or, you know, racial slurs, things like that, such that really, you know, we're taking those words out of context and saying, this is what they meant because they were there. So you can imagine, you know, an equally religious prayer, benediction, that doesn't have the words God in it, couldn't you? So that really, you know, how much does it matter that there is a particular word God? I mean, my sense is that your analogy runs even deeper because the hypothetical interlocutor might say back to you, well, in the same way that, you know, when Cohen said, fuck the draft, there was something about the word fuck that was particularly meaningful. So too, in the religious context, you know, there are ways in which the name God, or in some, you know, in some religions, like, there are names of God that can't be uttered, things like that, such that the word really does mean a lot. And I think that would be, you know, an interesting examination, wholesale, kind of, I think it would be a really good paper, to talk about, you know, taking words out of First Amendment cases, religion and speech. It's a really good question. I mean, I think that's certainly why that speech is there in Scalia's dissent. I would guess that Kennedy would have a hard time if that were the exact speech, right? Well, because first of all, let's just think this through. The question Michael poses, just to kind of bring everyone into the conversation, is, you know, if the benediction was not the one that's cited, that's quoted rather on page 566, but instead, bless you, is the one that's on page 572 that comes from George Washington, the speech George Washington made before his first official act as president, right? The problem is that, you know, there, if that were the exact speech, there would probably be less of a religious component, only because there, it would more likely be a historical event, right? So, like, for example, if you know, Martin Luther King never made his I Have a Dream speech, but I just came into class today and made it, it would be, you know, a really good class, right? It would sort of be weird, probably. So you'd be like, why? What did we do to deserve this? But if I came in and made the speech randomly, right, without any introduction even, just to make the case kind of better for you, you would just think, like, wow, I guess there must be some sort of historical reference that I'm missing for today. It's not Martin Luther King Day, right? But, you know, maybe it was a special day in class. And maybe, you know,
because of the specialness of that day in class, there was an occasion to make this very special speech. I imagine that the historical overtones would overtake whatever sort of references were particular in that speech. So, for example, I don't think you would come away thinking about equality as much as you might come away thinking, okay, there has to be some sort of historical reference, right? Similarly, if the benediction at this graduation was the exact benediction that George Washington made, I imagine that there may have been more discussion of, you know, well, this was a historical speech that was made, right?
You know, I guess I'm saying we kind of could be longer than that prayer. Say the wonderful prayer that George Washington, I'd like to offer the same prayer.
Right, but that's what I'm saying, that since... Yeah, I think that there would be more history. So, for example, you know, it would be different, even though George Washington's prayer had God in it, right? Since it's George Washington's prayer, which has a lot of, you know, secular historical meaning right now, okay, we don't think of George Washington as a rabbi. We don't remember him particularly as a religious or non-religious person. We think of him as the first president, right?
I guess maybe that's a good question. I was not very much with George Washington.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not with those historical
tools.
Yeah, I mean, but not a rabbi.
Yeah. I guess I'm trying to, I'm taken by the point that this speech had been given, it's hard to say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a fair point, that basically, you know, from whose mouth the speech comes does make a difference. And, I mean, that's not something that we're, not something that we've discussed a ton. But for example, you know, the example I give, I always throw chairs at your Chris. Justin or Chris?
Justin.
For some reason, there's always one person who I always mess up their names. And it's always like, I'm sure that it's the other name. So I'm sure you're Chris, even though I know you're Justin. Okay, so whenever I throw chairs at Justin, which I do often, or I talk about throwing chairs at him often, one of the things that I say that, you know, example for is I could throw chairs at Justin and it could be very expressive, right? I really hate you. I hate you so much that I'm going to throw a chair at you. Wouldn't be protected speech, but it's expressive nonetheless. Versus if he and I were playing chair catch. Like, let's say he and I were both, you know, really good at catching chairs. And so it wouldn't be that weird for me to throw a chair at him because it's really just for sport. So why do I bring that example up? Because we're not totally unfamiliar with the idea that, you know, the same speech or the same conduct could be taken in very different ways depending on the context. Part of the context is surely who is saying the speech. So if this were George Washington, as opposed to a rabbi or a priest or a minister, I think it's definitely true, and that Justice Kennedy would not be lost on this point, that... you know, despite the fact that there was God mentioning in the speech, that this was more likely to be a secular speech, right? I think the reason that the Kennedy opinion spends so much time discussing the school's policies, or sorry, the guidebook about, you know, not having the speech be very religious, right? The reason for spending so much time on that point is that the speech giver was a rabbi. Right, say if it were a priest or whatever, if it was George Washington or Barack Obama or whatever, then I imagine that even if there were mentionings of God in the speech, you know, probably, you know, the disposition of the case would have been different, and there wouldn't have been any sort of handbook delivered, because why would you imagine, why would you think that, you know, Barack Obama or George Washington is necessarily going to give a religious speech? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This probably isn't about high school students, but you probably can't, like, if you tell a lot of people about God, you're just probably not going to listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm trying to say to that is that in high school, I feel like, to be fair, most of the kids aren't really going to give credence to what's going on and feel like, oh, now I have to be Jewish, you know?
Right.
If they
and in fact, if I can interrupt you for a sec, you could probably find sources that suggest that that's exactly how not to make them.
Right. And if you, well, and that's the other thing, if someone is as conscientious that they would really be thinking about all the, okay, as a rabbi, maybe I should if they're like, I feel like they're more inclined to formulate their own opinion, and like you said, maybe not agree
right.
with what's going on, or feel like a conscientious objection.
Which is, I mean, Scalia doesn't.
So it's not necessarily the effect, it's just that it might, it's like it's capable of doing so.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, part of the thrust of Scalia's argument is that okay, all you have to do is stand, and you know, really, are we supposed to be protecting the types of people? I'm sure I can get a quotation during the break. I'll look for one that's particular, but I definitely remember reading in the Scalia opinion more of you know the sort of autonomy of high school students. Right, not psychology or autonomy of high school students, but this idea that, you know, nobody's going to have to come away from this graduation ceremony and go to shul, right? That's not the idea. Whether or not it's the effect is not of our concern. It's not a First Amendment concern. And if, you know, this is really only coercing you to stand, then, you know, it's not that problematic because, you know, A, you should be kind of, you should have the kind of wherewithal emotionally, intellectually to not stand if you don't want to stand. And moreover, you should definitely, you know, when the religion clauses are enacted, it's with the thought in mind that people are able to choose, you know, what's right for them. Yeah. Allison and then Patrick and then
the three. I guess that you can't get freedom from
religion
viewpoint.
Uh-huh.
But when the rabbi did the fact that it's actually at graduation, regardless, it's not a question of standing, I don't think it's only that day. If somebody doesn't believe what this person's saying, and religion is so controversial, and one of the reasons we have this separation is that discussion isn't long in those spheres. That this girl in particular had her day was consumed now by religion and God instead of on the graduation, it took her out of it.
I just wonder, though, whether the fact that, you know, this is religion is really that. Crucial, and that's the question, right? Because you can imagine that it would be really, like, I don't think this would be that terrible, because I tend to be very bored. I hate graduations to the extent I've never not go. I don't now have to go to a graduation for the rest of my life, and I am not happy about it. If anybody has a flask that they would like to pass me during graduation, that would be totally unobjectionable to me. But some people really like them. Fine. I hate graduations. They're not important to me. That doesn't mean that they're not important to everybody, right? I have gone to graduations because, like, my parents, you know, are like, can we at least go to an hour? And I'm like, okay, fine. So I've been. And if, for example, there was, you know, somebody giving a talk about why abortion is a bad thing, then I suppose I could say that that's, like, really objectionable to me. It's certainly not what I believe in. Or, like, why Jews and gay people should be killed. That is not a place I would want to be, right? But I would actually love the graduation, because as opposed to being bored out of my mind, I wouldn't be. And I'd be like, oh, great. You know, now, despite the fact that I have to pee, because you always have to pee at graduation, you know, I can think about this and not about peeing. So that would be fine for me, right? But I imagine Deborah Wiseman is of a different constitution. Like, she's, like, in her Sunday or Saturday best or whatever. You know, she's very excited about the graduation. But the thing is that, you know, why should we care that everybody has to say what Deborah wants to hear, right? So, because I happen to be a weirdo who wants everyone to be, like, totally inflammatory at me at the graduation, because then I won't be bored, which is my, you know, the thing I am most likely to be at a graduation ceremony. That doesn't mean that, you know, it should be protected, right? That's, like, the sort of speech that isn't violative of, you know, someone's rights. So, for example, you know, it's not your right as a graduation participant to not be bored or to have everybody say whatever it is that you want to hear. The fact that this is religious talk
maybe according to the, you know, the sixth approach, the equal liberty approach, shouldn't be so different from, you know, a graduation speaker who's talking about a political stance that you don't agree with. Just a thought. Let's break. I know that there are some hands, Kate and Patrick particularly, and we'll come back in 10.
I
All right, so why don't we continue our discussion? Patrick, I saw your hand up, and Kate, if you have any other thoughts.
So I buy back to the Washington speech, right? Like,
yeah.
I buy that it becomes historical once you reference George Washington, but mm-hmm. I feel like it actually becomes more coercive. Because, you know, if I log in as, you know, someone who isn't Jewish and see a rabbi speaking, right, mm-hmm. I sort of go, oh, well, it's a rabbi, so right, I'm not going to believe what they say necessarily, right?
Right.
I don't subscribe to the same religion. Whereas if
if a rabbi or someone else walks in and says, this really important historical figure that, you know, by and large, everyone thinks is, you know, a good person, believes in God, you should too. I think that's more likely to have a coercive effect on the, you know, impressionable graduation.
I think that's fair. You know, I think that's fair. So the point is that, you know, whereas one could think that a rabbi or a priest or some religious figure giving a speech would be more coercive, you might say the opposite, which is that somebody who you would less expect to give a religious speech but whose influence on religion might be higher because they are not associated with it, you know, that might be more coercive and not less. The idea being similar to, you know, if a particular like famous person wears like somebody's clothes without it being an advertisement but gets paid kind of secretly, or, you know, not that there are rules about this sort of thing, but like less overtly than having that person be the spokesperson for that brand, then the odds that you would more likely buy the brand might be higher because you say, oh, I saw, you know, Chuck Bass wearing this, not Chuck Bass is the face of K-Swiss, I'm going to wear K-Swiss's, even though I like that all the time. Okay, so that's fair. So that's kind of the coercion standpoint, and the counterpoint to Justice Kennedy's point. So I had a few other kind of passages that I thought were particularly helpful, bless you, in the Wiseman opinion, which, if you haven't noticed already, will definitely be on final, definitely be important to the class. And I would invite you to think about the parallels between this case and the Tabor case. For somewhat obvious reasons, they do come about in the same context, the school context. One is about speech, the other is about religion. So that kind of gets us, you know, a broad array of issues for you to deal with in a particular final exam setting. I happen to really enjoy plots that take place in school settings. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if the final appears in a school setting. I haven't written the final yet because I don't know if you've ever taken any of my finals, but it's like a whole to-do for me. I work really hard on my finals. And if you ever tell me that they're really great, I will remember you forever. Okay. So, even though we'll probably be Facebook friends forever anyway, so I'll remember you even if you don't do that. Okay. So, there is a speech versus religion passage that I want to call your attention to in light of the fact that I've just said, you know, how much I love the school setting because, A, you know, show me a movie about anything happening in school and I will see it. I will see it twice, maybe three times. But apart from that, there are cases that we've dealt with in the school setting that deal with speech, most notably Tinker, and cases that have dealt with religion in the school setting. So that is a perfect setting for our final because we can deal with both. And we have had cases that have dealt with both. But the passage that I want to draw your attention to is on the bottom of page 568, the top of page 569. Does anyone mind reading it on our behalf just because I want to spare you my frog voice for just a moment? Adam, why don't you read? Bottom of page 568, the First Amendment protects.
The First Amendment protects speech and religion by quite speech is protected by ensuring its full expression even when the government participates. The very object of some of our most important speech is to persuade the government to adopt an idea as its own. The method for protecting freedom of worship and freedom of conscience in religious matters is quite the reverse. In religious debate or expression, the government is not a prime participant. The framers deemed religious establishment antithetical to the freedom of law. The Free Exercise Clause embraces a freedom of conscience and worship with close parallels in the speech provisions of the First Amendment. But the Establishment Clause is a specific prohibition on forms of state intervention in religious affairs with no precise counterpart in the speech provisions. The explanation lies in the lesson of history that was and is the inspiration for the establishment clause. The lesson that in the hands of government, what might begin as tolerant expression of religious views may end in a policy to indoctrinate and coerce. A state-created orthodoxy puts at great risk that freedom of belief and conscience which are the sole assurance that religious faith is real, not imposed.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so here we have kind of an aside that Justice Kennedy offers us about the differences and similarities between the religious clauses taken together and the principles that govern the speech clause. And here we have, as we've talked about before, a parallel between the free exercise clause and the speech clause, not so much of a parallel between the establishment clause and the speech clause. Why? Because the court says, and Adam just read, that speech is protected by ensuring its full expression. Even when the government participates, for the very object of some of our most important speech is to persuade the government to adopt an idea as its own. Whereas, so it's essentially a top-down, bottom-up dichotomy, right? So when we're talking about speech, the idea is that everybody has opinions. Everybody in the populace, that's what democracy is about. Everybody has opinions. Lots of those opinions conflict and are different from other opinions by other people in the world, right, in the United States, whatever. And in light of that situation, in light of the fact there are tons of people with lots of opinions, and those lots of people with lots of opinions, tons of opinions, want to express them, right? We have the speech clause. The speech clause says that, Congress can't make a law that cuts, that curtails that. So that's a bottom-up, right? Where we get from the bottom the opinions of the populace that are then protected by the First Amendment, which basically curbs Congress's right to make any laws that curtails the rights collectively of the populace to express their differing opinions. The top-down approach is the one that we see most pointedly in the Establishment Clause arena. Because in the Establishment Clause arena, we don't necessarily assume that there are lots of religions that people want to express themselves for. Right? Could be the case, but that's not the focus. The focus is on whether the government can or can't make a particular rule. Because what it's trying to do through that rule is to establish a religion as the dominant one, right? In the context of speech, more often than not, the highest value speech concerns the populace trying to convince the government to adopt a particular position, right? We think of political speech as the most valuable speech, right? And if speech is there in order to convince everyone around you in the marketplace of ideas, that your idea is the best. Sure, you could be talking about celebrities and clothes, and that wouldn't be low-value speech. But the highest of high-value speech would be, I want the government to do X, right? I want this policy to change. You disagree with me, let's have a debate. If we can have a debate in a park where there might be lots of press, that would be the most high value of high-value speech, the object of which is to actually get the government to change a particular policy, right? It's not the only type of speech that is protected, but it's certainly the highest of high-value speech. That's not the sort of thing that goes on in the context of religion, right? When people adopt the tenets of a particular religion, it's not as though they're doing that in order for the government to say, oh, wow, that religion seems to be doing great. They're all working really hard, and they're very fit, and they seem really nice, and we are now going to have that religion be the religion of the state, right? That's exactly not what the religion clauses are intended to do, and in some sense, that is what the speech clauses are intended to do. Okay, so in addition to just sort of different doctrines, right, different words of the First Amendment, there is this difference in approach between a bottom-up speech approach, right, where the populace is trying to convince the government to take a particular position, and the government can't try and incentivize one viewpoint over another. Contrast that with the religion clauses, which even though they are different from each other, right, the religion clauses say that it's not about whether the government is going to adopt a particular religion. The particular rules assume that people have the right to do their own thing. Okay?
that shows up both in the Establishment Clause and in the Free Exercise Clause. The Establishment Clause says that in order to preserve the right of the people to do their own thing with respect to religion, you know, you, the government, can't establish one,
right? Or you can't make rules
respecting an establishment of religion. In the context of the Free Exercise Clause, there's still a top-down approach, not bottom-up like the Free Speech Clauses, although there are more parallels between Free Exercise and the Speech Clause. Still a top-down approach, because never is there this contention that the government is going to adopt the position of a particular religion that certain individuals in the citizenry are allowed to believe in, in the way that the Free Speech Clause contemplates. Okay, so that's another point that comes across in this case that I wanted to highlight. Moving along the court's reasoning, we also see, and this is important for the school setting in particular, which, as I said, is an important setting for you all to focus on. In the school setting, there are heightened concerns, says the court on page 569 in the second full paragraph, with protecting freedom of conscience from subtle coercive pressure in the elementary school and secondary public schools. What to most believers may seem nothing more than a reasonable request that the non-believer respect their religious practices, in a school context may appear to the non-believer or dissenter to be an attempt to employ the machinery of the state to enforce a religious orthodoxy. Now, we're not unfamiliar, after Tinker, with special rules that govern schools. Right? You remember that? So in the context of Tinker, the special rule that governed schools was whether a particular expression did something to distract the educational environment that was the primary purpose of the school. Now, we also saw that in the case of the materials that followed Tinker, that particular standard was not followed. Okay, so then we were not operating by way of the "is this distracting" standard. But in the context of Tinker, that certainly was very important to the court to understand, you know, that the school's main purpose was to educate children. You can't educate children if they're distracted. So if this particular form of expression was going to provide, you know, sufficient distraction to detract from the educational environment that the school's primary purpose is devoted to, then that expression and the outlawing of that expression by the school doesn't violate the First Amendment. We're all dying. Okay. So here we have a special rule for schools, which is what? What's the special consideration for schools that the court voices here? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're very vulnerable. And I imagine Don might have something to say about this, right? That, you know, according to your last point here in the passage that I just read, about the vulnerability of these particular students, there's a lumping together of primary and secondary public school students. I imagine that you might have something to say about whether that lumping together is justified.
I feel like they, by virtue of the fact of what's said, they assume that the word is, I think in the paragraph thereafter, he says, but who has a reasonable perception that she is being forced by the state. I'm not so sure that that's a reasonable perception.
I'm not following. Well, yeah. I suppose my limited concern for right this second was just whether, if we're looking at two cases, this and Tinker, which seem to have special rules that apply in school settings. In the Tinker case, you know, there can be a lot said about the value of having a rule that's particular to the school context in Tinker about distracting other students, right? Here, there seems to be a rule that in the context of, you know,
of talking about religion. I didn't even say coercion. I didn't say forcing. Just talking about religion in the context of a public primary or secondary school setting, there's a certain vulnerability, to borrow Michael's word, which I think nicely explains this, that applies in that setting that doesn't apply in other settings. And, you know, one way that one might argue against this is to say, well, fine, this is an okay rule for primary school, but it might not be an okay rule for secondary school. There's no rule, right, that just because, you know, you have a special rule, you, the court, have imposed a special rule on public schools, that you have to impose it on all public schools. You can impose it on some and not others. And if you're going to, you know, derive the sum that you do impose this vulnerability on, then if you're going to derive that principle from, you know, psychology, because it certainly doesn't come from law, right? There's no law that says, like, people who are in kindergarten will act this way, people who are in fifth grade will act this way. That's a psychology principle. So that, you know, it's certainly not the case that the Constitution or any other common law precedent requires you, the court, to impose the same rules to primary and secondary students. Now, an argument on the other side might be, well, sure, you might say that primary students and secondary school students have different reasons for being vulnerable. So, for example, you know, if you look back to your own childhood, you know, in third grade, you might have been more likely to believe what your teacher said without questioning it. Maybe, maybe not. But I imagine you were more likely to do that than you were in 10th grade, right? But you might be more vulnerable to things like peer pressure in 10th grade than you were in 3rd grade. So even though, you know, there is a different set of vulnerabilities that attends the 3rd grader from those that attend the 10th grader, they might not be any different in a way, you know, such that vulnerability shouldn't be taken into account at all in the context of a 10th grader. Yeah.
Similar vein that maybe the course define a protection overall, so that in case that there are vulnerable like 10th graders, so it's like they're on the side of caution.
Well, but I wonder then if erring on the side of caution is also erring on the side of violating the Constitution, right? Because if you take seriously the idea that, you know, these students should be allowed to do whatever, right? And you know, the religion clauses do not, like, you want to have a pretty narrow construction of the religion clauses. And so I wonder if being kind of overprotective of the students underprotects you for the constitutional purpose.
But maybe, like, since the school is like a special place, that you should find it differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly worthy. I just want to kind of delve into exactly how differently and exactly why it should be different. Can I see another hand? No? Okay. All right, so I don't, you know, it's not a debate that we're going to solve. But it is something to think about, whether there should be this kind of special rule in the school setting or not. And then there is, the court goes on to talk about, you know, and this relates to this psychological coercion point that Kennedy and Scalia have vastly different opinions on. So Kennedy not only says that there's a psychological coercion to stand up and to kind of respect the other religion and do what everyone else is doing, but moreover, that what matters is that given our social conventions, a reasonable dissenter in this milieu could believe that the group exercise signified her own participation or approval in it. And this is on the heels of a discussion about whether there is a perception on the part of other students, on the part of anyone around, that if you stood, then you believed. And of course, you know, the perception of your belief
maybe should count for a lot. I'm not saying it definitely should count for a lot, but it seems that Kennedy seems to value it pretty highly, right? That it's not just that you would stand up because all your friends are around you. It's not just that you might, you know, mumble whatever the words are if your friends are doing that too, but that there's a perception that if you did those things, which you may have been psychologically coerced to do, that there would be a perception that you agreed with them, which is a separate point from the coercion, right? Because you could have been coerced to do this, but not communicated effectively that you were being coerced. You can imagine, for example, if you told me, you know, let's say there was a guy with a gun who came to our class, God forbid, right, and said, you know, I don't know, get down on your knees and say a prayer, right? And I did that because there was a gun. You probably wouldn't think that I was doing that because I believed in it. Why? Because there's a gun, right? If, for example, somebody just came in and said that without a gun and he or she didn't look particularly scary, but I did it anyway, and for whatever reason, you know, I have a really low tolerance for people telling me what to do. I'll do whatever anyone says, and I just did it. There's more likelihood, without the gun and without the kind of big, scary person that you might have been envisioning in the first image, that I doing this, that I getting down and, you know, doing whatever this person said would be perceived as though I believed in whatever it was, you know, whatever the benediction was that I was supposed to say. So there's the coercion point and the perception of agreement with the prayer. I'm going to add perception by others around you. Okay, so there's the psychological coercion point, which we've discussed, and then this additional point that flows from the psychological coercion to kind of stand up and do what everyone else is doing, that says that there's a perception, if you did that, by others around you, of your agreement with whatever this prayer is, whatever you're saying, whatever you're going through the motions in order to respect. Okay. So, okay. And then just to finish out the Kennedy opinion, I've got a couple quotations that I think are helpful that I've highlighted on page 571. One comes from the middle of the first full paragraph on the page, the sentence that starts with "a relentless." So a relentless and all-pervasive attempt to exclude religion from every aspect of public life could itself become inconsistent with the Constitution. So this, I think, Kate, relates to our discussion in the hallway. Kate's question, which I think was astute, was, you know, let's say that Deborah Wiseman, the atheist's opinion won out. And, you know, that instead of having a benediction, there was nothing. There was nothing religious, no mention of God. You know, that the secular handbook was really, really strict. And George Washington gave his speech instead of Rabbi Leslie, whomever. If that were true, then would that effectively, that secular speech, be promoting her atheist conception rather than, you know, some particular religion or religion at all? There's certainly a thought both ways, right? There's certainly a thought, you know, Scalia would say for sure, which I, you know, for obvious reasons, you know, obvious reasons cashed out would mean something like, you know, his whole beginning of the dissent, where he talks about, you know, the tradition of having religious benedictions said at really, you know, important events. If there were an absence, then there's kind of like an excludio principle there. So, you know, if there were all of these important events that always had mentions of God, and then there was one that didn't, then that's essentially a promotion of an atheist
point of an atheist worldview as opposed to just the absence of God. The absence of God being distinct from an affirmative atheist perspective. You know, again, I think it could be framed in a number of different ways, but it's certainly possible that someone would say that, and it's certainly very likely that Scalia would say that. Yeah. Right.
But he doesn't think that an individual is wrong, but they can think wrong with the Like, it seems just strange to me. Like, in one case, the conduct is significant, and in the other, it's not significant at all.
Yeah, I mean, I would want to think about that a little more globally, because I think that it would require, you know, a deeper examination of, like, Scalia on groups versus Scalia on individuals. And, you know, right now, I mean, I don't have at my fingertips a set of data that would indicate, you know, differences with respect to adjudicating cases on behalf of either of those different, you know, groups is not the wrong word, but adjudication of cases for individuals versus adjudication of cases for groups. But, I mean, it's certainly easier to gauge tradition from groups than it is from individuals, even if there was, you know, you can imagine a tradition of individuals, like, screaming their heads off on college campuses for one reason or another. And then, you know, if you got that from a traditionalist angle, it would be an interesting thing for Scalia to contend with, but I can't think of an example right now about, you know, kind of a more complete understanding of his conception in those instances. So it's definitely important to both sides that there be some level of tradition. And I imagine that on Kennedy's side, I mean, Kennedy is right now a moderate, but, you know, if you were to say 20 years ago that Kennedy would be a moderate as opposed to a conservative, that would have been crazy. So that's just an interesting point to think about. I mean, this is a very conservative court, and the idea that Kennedy is, you know, the person who penned the majority opinion in Lawrence versus Texas and is, you know, considered a swing vote at all is a little bit crazy as a matter of history. So it's not completely surprising that tradition plays a role in both of their opinions, but from a strategic perspective, from a constitutional decision-making perspective, it's also not crazy to think that they both give particular weight to tradition, because, of course, if Kennedy knows that Scalia is going to bark about tradition, then, you know, it's certainly, I mean, it's just like writing a brief where you know the other side. You're not going to completely ignore tradition if your other side is going to say tradition matters so much. But in addition to that, you know, Kennedy is not such a liberal, so we shouldn't be, you know, too swayed into thinking that he's, like, our savior. Or, you know, whoever would characterize themselves as liberal savior. So he says, you know, unsurprisingly, that it's not right to exclude religion from everything that the Constitution deals with. But, you know, he still obviously takes the view that here is not the place to include it. And then the last quotation that I wanted to draw your attention to is in the last sentence of that same paragraph on page 571 that I just drew your attention to, where Kennedy says that the sole question presented is whether a religious exercise may be conducted at a graduation ceremony, right, in circumstances where, as we have found, young graduates who object are induced to conform. Okay, so the fact that they're young matters, the fact that they are objecting matters, and the fact that there is some evidence in Kennedy's opinion, right, which is Scalia and maybe you might think is not sufficient evidence, but some evidence offered in Kennedy's opinion that there is a real inducement to their conforming.
Okay. And again, that is the psychological concern.
Coercion. Okay. Now, on the Scalia side of things, you know, we have a very different story here, right? So he talks about, you know, the tradition of prayer at big events. He cites, as we talked about before, Michael brought it up, George Washington's, you know, religiously motivated speech that references the Almighty Being, capital A, capital B, and, you know, the fact that really that speech wasn't really different from the rabbi's speech at the graduation. Bless. So, you know, why mess with this tradition, says Scalia, of having, you know, mentioning of God at these really big, important events? Because really, you know, what is a big event without some acknowledgement of God? And, you know, it's interesting, because I imagine that there is some resistance to religion among some of you that probably is, you know, a testament to your time, more so than, you know, those of you at another time, right? I think that the freedom from religion group has, you know, become larger, become more vociferous in recent years. So it's not, you know, it's a harder case to make, certainly, to a group of people who might not think that religion is an important aspect to tradition. But if you think about, you know, and I really don't care for religion in any event. And I go home for Rosh Hashanah, I do everything that I'm supposed to do according to my parents. But, you know, that said, you know, I don't want religion at graduation. I don't want it anywhere that is not, like, with my mom's cooking. And a lot of it. So, a lot of cooking, not a lot of religion. But in any event, that said, you know, there is something to the fact that if there is a tradition, and if there is a clause that's only supposed to provide the government some sort of restriction, right, to not go over certain boundaries with respect to the citizens that it governs, then taking into account the sorts of things that are normal that the populace who is governed does should be relevant, right? So here, you know, whereas you might disagree about how much religion should or shouldn't be a part of daily life, right? The question is not about that. The question is about, you know, whether the Constitution provides, and to what extent, that the government shouldn't interfere with what's already going on. So if what's already going on is a tradition of having God, you know, being spoken about at particular events, then should the freedom to have people do that be cut short by way of the government? I'm not saying the answer is yes or no, but to frame the question that way, I think, takes away some of the force that a person like me, right, who's pretty anti-religious, okay, from, you know, this debate, okay, because even though I'm sure I'm not as religious as Scalia, right, I don't have 9 children, I'm definitely not as religious as Scalia, but that doesn't mean that I, because I'm not as religious as Justice Scalia, can't plausibly share a view that he might take with respect to the religion clauses, because even though it's not my tradition, shouldn't there be, you know, some autonomy on the part of the governed to have a continuation of a tradition in which God, or anything else for that matter, right, spoken about at religious events, such that the constitutional prohibition on the government from infiltrating those events has to be curbed? Okay? So I say this because, you know, my guess is that most of you, based on knowing you for, you know, a few hours this semester, most of you probably disagree with this opinion. And so that's, I think, the most important time for us, you know, to really consider the merits of the opinion. just because it's probably something that you disagree with, as opposed to talking about opinions that you more likely do agree with, and why they're right, which is more comfortable but less intellectually engaging. Okay, so then we get to, you know, the thrust of the disagreement between Scalia and Kennedy, which is this idea of, you know, whether the students were actually coerced. So on page 573, which is part 2A that's excerpted in the Wiseman dissent, you know, we see this progression of Scalia's argument, where he says essentially that psychological coercion is not actual coercion, even if there was actual coercion involved in this case, which of course he contends that there wasn't. But even if there was, it wasn't to do anything religious. It was only to stand. And he ends that by saying that he would deny that the dissenter's interest, Wiseman's interest, in avoiding even the false appearance of participation constitutionally trumps the government's interest in fostering respect for religion generally. Okay, so he is never saying, you know, that the government is supposed to impose on anyone a particular religion, because that, of course, would run afoul of the Establishment Clause. What he is saying is that, you know, in light of this tradition, in light of the fact that there are at least some people who take seriously that the religion clauses are about a freedom of religion, right? That there is a mandate from the Constitution, according to the Establishment Clause, that individuals respect other people's religion, right? In the context of standing up when, you know, a certain prayer is being said, you know, we can have debates about this. In the context of a lack of respect, meaning something akin to a Holocaust, which emanates also from a lack of respect for a particular religion, the stakes are greater and the debate would likely be a lot lesser. So, you know, what his point is, you know, sure, like, you could make the argument that you're coercing someone into doing something. Standing, but whatever, you're coercing someone into doing something. But, you know, really, if we balance this personal, you know, this Deborah Wiseman, one Deborah Wiseman, dissenting views, not to stand against the more general principle that, you know, the Constitution and the law, you know, the judiciary that interprets it is supposed to foster a respect for religion, then, you know, it's at least possible that her view and her kind of First Amendment right shouldn't trump that of, you know, the religions who would not be respected otherwise. Yeah. Screaming her head off.
She doesn't have to stand up and be respectful. She does it very quietly. The other thing is, I don't think Scalia is very respectful of the religious law. I don't remember the name of the case, but basically, Indians wanted to perform their sacred rituals, and that involved him in daily. And he
right.
So there was a leap.
Right.
So I don't, this guy, if it's not Judeo-Christian,
Allison and then Rosa.
I wonder if we would have thought, had it been down in Indiana and you know, mostly Lutheran school where they got up and said a different kind of prayer, and you know, somebody who was a Christian, think about it.
Right.
We have the same view.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a good question. Yeah, Rose on that game.
I don't think that it's because it's just something. I don't think that I don't think that the fact that something is split tradition should be enough to say that, you know, it should be allowed, or that they should have some sort of respect. Because there's a lot of traditions that we discard all the time, or traditions that could have other negative effects on society.
Mm-hmm.
So who's to say, you know, what tradition we should keep and what traditions we should discard? Why, you know, give that to the courts? It shouldn't really be up to the courts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, Kate?
I can't
speak
for Lydia, but I don't think, when I was looking at the Henry mentioned the year before, I think there's a community standard point where if it was another religion, the community that followed that religion,
yeah, and then the question would be, you know, to what extent are we supposed to follow the majority?
Right. I'm just saying, I don't think.
Mark, by the way, the Smith case, which is a family case, is the last case we'll see. So,
I don't know if this would affect things, but what if the school were to, like, give an option, not an opt-out, but hey, this is a vote, these are our three speakers, mm-hmm. and then the majority is voting for the religious, you know, ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, I guess I'm conducting something like that, like a vote,
mm-hmm.
and then do end up as a religious voter or speaker, I mean, what could you do if it's still a state actor, but there's still a majority voting for it?
Mm-hmm.
Would that change things?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting question, which is a very frustrating answer, I imagine. But I mean that because then, you know, you certainly have an expressive voice from the people about, you know, what it is that they're doing. The coercion argument wouldn't be as strong, right? Because if you're there, then you're definitely into it, right? Unless you're Patrick and you're there because you want to be not into it. But you know, the idea there would be different in the sense that they're, you know, the school is allowing, just to get the terms of your game correct, would there be three speeches offered? Or it's just a vote and then one wins?
Yeah, that's one non-religious, one religious.
But then on graduation day, there's how many speeches?
Just
one. Yeah, so that might be a little different. Because if there were three speeches on graduation day, you kind of choose, it would be, you know, probably never happen, which means it might be like a good exam question. But not to say that I would pick that exam question, but I just mean hypothetically, because it's different in the sense that there is choice in a way that there isn't here. So the coercion wouldn't really play as much. But I don't know. Yeah.
Starting the peers saying, hey, this is the religion, or this is what we view. Here's the speech we're going to pose that everyone now has to listen to, and everyone has to participate in.
No, but that's why I asked whether there were any three on graduation day.
Well, right,
but I was assuming there were three before that. Right. I think you're right, that if there was one, the coercion factor would go up. Yeah. Mark.
Oh, I was just going to say before that, if it is community standards doesn't seem to be the reason to allow this, because this is the whole point of both clauses of protection minorities.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. But, you know, then the question would be, you know, in the obscenity context, we have a doctrine that mandates that we consider community standards. In any other First Amendment setting, community standards play kind of a negative role, opposed to a positive one, because we're supposed to be protecting the minority from the majority.
Mm-hmm. Going back to Alex's comment, though, but if it were more coercive, it wouldn't be the state doing it anymore. Now it's the students who are, you know, private individuals.
Right, but it's the state who's running the vote.
Okay.
Yeah.
When they vote about whether or not, I think I read it in about whether or not to vote to have a ceremony or a football game.
That wasn't allowed. Let me go back because. Yeah, I seem to remember that as well. Hold on. Does it follow the Lynch case? Yeah. Okay, so Santa Fe versus Doe held up constitutional districts policy that authorized students to vote first whether to allow invocations at high school football games and then to choose a person to deliver them. Justice Stevens concluded that the speech the selected student gave would not be private speech because the policy authorizing an election in which a majority would determine whether to have invocations. The court then held that an invocation at a high school football game violated the principle established in Lee. The Establishment Clause was designed to remove debate over this kind of issue from governmental supervision or control. So the delivery of a religious invocation would therefore coerce them in the way condemned in Lee. So the vote does not make this okay. Right. Yeah, so that's a helpful citation, and it seems that voting doesn't take you away from the problem here, but you know I do wonder whether a vote could be set up in such a way that's different from this particular football game case because it's not about the vote, right? You know, so for example, if there were three choices of speeches. But for example, you know, all of the people who exert the most peer pressure are going to the religious speech. And, you know, the school was the one that made this choice available. But for example, put the religious speech in the room where, you know, most people were likely to go or something along those lines. Then I wonder whether the coercion principle would still play a role at all. It certainly play a lesser one. But it's interesting to see how, you know, you can manipulate the circumstances such that there's a little bit less coercion. Okay, so next time we'll talk about free exercise. I'll see you Wednesday.